Okay, tonight our class is titled Touring the Homes of the Wealthy, Entertainment or Coveting? So let's as they say, let's go, let us go to the, this is another exploration of the mitzvah of Lo Tachmod, thou shalt not cover the tenth of the Ten Commandments. We're going to get into that. Jealousy, envy, coveting. We're getting in there. So let's get into a video. Obviously, I'll share that. Here we go. As they say, let us go to the videotape. Called Inside the World's Multi-Million Dollar Homes. Here we go.
The world's richest people spend over £1 trillion every year living the luxury life.
The quality of this yacht is just incredible.
You can feel the soul of nature at your doorstep, and that's luxury.
Luxury is a universe. It's an experience.
Discover the secrets of a luxury world where only the best is good enough.
Cartier champagne. It's tricky finding properties for the billionaire community because they don't compromise.
Revealing that it's about more than just flashing the cash.
True luxury is about having whatever you want and however you want it.
Meet the most discerning customers in the world.
There's always someone who's willing to have the next best thing. So did I just choose the most expensive ring?
You did.
Behind the scenes with the people making wishes come true for the world's wealthiest customers.
You have to be thinking 10 steps ahead of your client. In the middle of the night, one member of the band orders fresh milk from a cow from a farm.
There's a lady who would only bathe in Evian water.
My goal is to achieve perfection.
The world's most luxurious.
Julia!
What's for lunch?
The champagne,
yes,
souffle.
This is why we live in a Pelicano, right?
Yes.
We get to eat what we want, when we want, with whom we want.
Uh-huh.
Is there a better view ever?
Liz Edlich lives in one of the most luxurious homes in the world, right on the beach in Malibu, California.
Lunchtime, champagne, ocean, dolphins, pelicans. And at the Pelicano, you can't just have a normal chandelier. You have to have an Amazonian jungle vine that I turned into a chandelier. Now that's luxury.
Across the globe, luxury is the goal, and there is no shortage of pricey properties for those who can afford them. From sprawling English estates to vertical metropolitan living, where space is definitely at a premium. And currently under construction, the most expensive luxury home in the world at $500 million.
Millionaires, billionaires, they want to create something that will leave their mark. So they may, if they're available, take a piece of land somewhere and create something truly unique. Somewhere that is almost a legacy for them, somewhere that's so unique.
But what's it like to actually live in one of these luxury homes? Just 10 miles north of Los Angeles, California, lies the perfect spot for a beachside retreat, Malibu. Buying a property along this exclusive 27-mile-long ocean front also bags you some pretty fancy neighbors, including Lady Gaga, Pierce Brosnan, and Barbara Streisand. Rubbing shoulders with these celebrity neighbors is skincare CEO Liz, a woman who knows exactly what she wants.
20 years ago, I was sitting down on this beach right here and looking up at this promontory, this rocky promontory that had a little white cinder block beach shack on it, called it Moondoggy's Beach Shack. And I said, oh my gosh, what would it be like to be able to live on that rock, surrounded by nature, two private beaches. And 5 years later, I bought it.
What Liz wants, Liz gets.
After waiting 7 years for permission to rebuild on the spot, she spent almost $1 million on steel supports to anchor the house to the rock. She didn't have to look too far to find a name for her new home. A huge rock favored by local pelicans sits right outside the window.
You can feel the soul of Il Pelicano in and on the walls, just like you can feel the soul of nature at your doorstep. It's all reclaimed from parts of Europe, Egypt, France, Italy, and so all touched by the human hand. And that's luxury at its finest.
Lisa's personal approach to luxury is built from the pieces she's imported from her travels around the globe, with no expense spared. Like a magpie collecting everything that sparkles, Liz is always happy to showcase her wares.
To me, this is what luxury looks and feels like. It's collecting things from all over the world, from literally a door surround that I turned in to a fireplace, to then the ceiling from Sri Lanka. This is a 100-year-old Borneo clamshell.
No multi-million dollar mansion is complete without a fossilized wash basin or a door imported from rural France.
This is one of my favorite doors. Between the carvings, the antique glass, and the door handle, it's just magic.
There's more to life in a luxury home than just magic door handles.
From sunrise to sunset, I literally come down here and I'll have my cup of coffee and espresso and tea in the morning. El Pelicano, it's a microclimate. So you're out there, you're hot, you're getting your suntan, you're walking on the beach, and then you come in, you're having a glass of champagne. I sit there and I'm able to watch the sunset.
Liz's self-build is a pastiche of history from around the world. But in places with centuries of tradition, it's the existing heritage which goes down well with luxury house hunters.
When people are looking for a home, they're, you know, very...
All right. We got the basic idea.
Yeah, it looks super, super nice.
I live in the rat hole.
All right, I'm here to help you out, guys. I'm here to help you out.
I feel bad for her.
All right. Okay. All right, so let's... Okay, we're gonna get into this. Okay, number one, why do so many people love to watch these type of shows? This is a reality TV show, which is a genre. Bravo TV. He's filled tons of shows like this. Why? What's the enjoyment? Is Adrian saying I'm living in a rat hole? Don't I feel it's gonna make me feel bad?
It's like if you ever won the lottery, what would you? I didn't feel bad. I felt like I think I would take that house.
Do you think you'd take that house? You think you'd suffer on a beachfront house in Malibu, private beach, by the way, on both sides of the promontory there? Okay, you know, you would suffer through that house. Okay, that.
I think of all the. Look at that.
All right, but so you're saying number one, people watch it because it's aspirational. What are the reasons? Why else are people watching the show?
And it's an escape.
An escape, right? This person's living a life that is not mine, and obviously I want. What else?
And you're essentially coveting.
We're gonna get into that.
Sometimes you're speaking Lashon Hara because you like to watch these things and then make fun of the person.
All right, so you get it's enjoying to. All right, we're going to get to that. So that gets into my next question. Is the wealthy woman, the wealthy lady, a sympathetic character? Why and why not?
Not really. She seems very new money to me. That's a really bitchy thing to say.
Yeah.
Right.
Notice there was.
She's showing off her wealth, right? People who and she wants to make sure that you know everything about it. So no, she's not sympathetic because nobody likes somebody who's into. You have to keep your wealth private in order to actually show it.
Right. Okay. But
it was kind of sad that it seemed.
Anna, do we lose? We lost Anna. Anna was about to say something.
I was thinking it's gonna be profound too. I hope she says it again.
I'm gonna go, Anna.
Don't lose your train of thought when you're on freeze.
Dad. Anna, we didn't hear you. You froze out, Anna.
You're on the verge of greatness there. Okay, let's see. So it seems like she gets her value from.
No. That's hilarious.
All right, we Anna, we didn't hear you.
Okay, try it one more time. Okay, she gets her value from her items. She feels good about herself based on what she has and what she's acquired, and how much money she's able to spend. So it's about things.
Things and also making sure that you know about it. It's not only about her acquiring things, about her also letting everybody know. As Casey said, the new money emotion. You know, she's not even doing the humble brag. She's just bragging. It's just straight out bragging.
This is what luxury is. I'm just making sure you understand.
Right. Basically, you guys watching this were a bunch of losers. You don't got this. I got it. I'm the prom queen. You're the losers that don't got the date. That's basically she was communicating that. Now I don't know if there was one particular 3-second quiz. She says now she has a name for the property. Did anybody catch that?
El Pelicano.
All right, something like a Pelicano, whatever. Right, so obviously a person who names their own house is a separate name. Okay, that's already the next level. And then you have the Spanish help. And then she says, everybody loves to live in El Pelicano and eat what you want and do what you want. And you saw the very weak smile of the poor Spanish help probably making $11 an hour, 15 maybe. Okay, yeah, we love it here. It's great to serve you. We love living in El Pelicano, right? Okay, so now, and what do you think about the woman in the other clip that says, she asks, well, did I pick out the most expensive diamond ring in the store? What about that woman? You want to spend some time with that woman?
No.
Or do you want to put a bag overhead and asphyxiate her? Which one did you feel more prone toward? Just okay, good. I'm happy to hear that. Very healthy. Yeah, very healthy. I don't want to hang out with her, nor do I want to murder her. That's healthy. Okay, good. Now, this is a key question. Now, this is the chop. Get into a little chop here. Now, why do you think the show brings out this character of the wealthy ladies? What does the technique of filming fit into the purpose of the show? What are they trying to elicit? What feelings are they trying to elicit?
Feelings in us?
Feelings in the viewer, yes.
Like jealousy, or envy?
Yeah, jealousy and envy, yes. And? But why having these very unsympathetic characters?
Because it allows us to feel better about not having all that stuff.
Okay, so not
we get to say, ooh, they have such nice stuff, but at least I don't suck.
Number one, correct. What else?
I have better taste in bacon.
There's another angle. Another angle is that why is this loser getting the gorgeous Malibu house? I deserve the house way more than that person. I'm a much better person.
This is an accurate statement, by the way.
So therefore, it allows you to facilitate hey, you know, that person is, you know, an unsympathetic and clearly not good person, you know, as much as we can tell on 5 seconds of tape. And therefore, I feel very entitled that I should have their house. You know, so that's, I think that's part of the lure. Not only, there's a number of lures going on. One, there's a voyeuristic interest, and people like to be nosy and see what other people's lives are like. One, good, bad, whatever. They're voyeuristic. That's called Facebook. That's called Instagram. Looking at people's lives and say, hey, they're better yet, they're highly curated online social media existence, which is only a weak reflection of the reality of their lives, i.e. their people put on Facebook and Instagram is sort of their marketing self. In other words, that's my brand. That's not my life. That's my brand. Okay? Point number one. So there's a voyeuristic enjoyment. Everybody likes to compare what that person got with that person. Two is that they create this, by the way, why do they think they frequently use a British, a narrator?
Oh, I know this one, because all British people are sophisticated and rich.
Well, we as Americans have that, well, they, by the way, there's like about 20 different, accents in Great Britain, but the one they'll always select is what kind of accent within the British accent?
London, the like posh one, but I think it's a British show because she said at the beginning people
pounds.
Say pounds.
Yeah, but if everybody remembers back in the first one of this genre was the lifestyles of the rich and famous, and it was always the Brit, and part of the British thing because part of the British motif is idea of classism. You have these British lords that have inherited these great mansions for absolutely no reason, you know. Other than being connected to royalty through marriage or whatever from, you know, the 1600s, you know, why should they get anything? But it brings that class divide, which we as Americans really hate. So it creates sort of like these very unsympathetic characters, and therefore feeling like we feel entitled, like we wish them that we would get their stuff because they're clearly not good people. They're wealthy, entitled, stuck-up, undeserving people, and we should have their stuff. Okay? It lends itself to that emotion, and that draws you in. So that's done by design. Okay. So now we'll pivot here. I'm gonna do a little share screen for a moment here. Love you have Adrian. Adrian, read us out question number 6, please.
The Raman states that one should not be greedy, rushing for wealth and possessions, nor lazy and an idler from work. Rather, he should be of a goodly eye and limit his business endeavors so that he may occupy himself with Torah study. He should be happy with the little which is his life. Why does he assume that people only have a little?
Okay, so let me break that down first. So the Rambam is talking about what we call the famous point, the golden mean. In other words, the middle. In other words, you shouldn't be greedy and rushing and just pursuing wealth and possessions, nor lazy and not working, but allowing you to be able to, but being generous and be able to allow time to learn and not just spend your whole time being consumed by work. And then he has that last line, which Adrian read, and he or she, obviously, should be happy with the little which is their lot. Now, why does Ram assume that everybody has a little? Clearly, we saw on the show, not everybody has a little. Why does Ram say that a person should be happy with the little which is their lot?
So, two reasons come to mind.
Go ahead, Casey.
First, practical. Back when Rambam lived, there were poor people, mostly only, and then occasional rich people. But most people were just poor.
I don't know. There were poor people, but there was a middle class. There was, you know, a merchant class. There were people who were, you know, lawyers, doctors like the Rambam. There were people who were, you know, people who had a business and who did were middle. It wasn't only stratified as a few wealthy people and everybody else is poor. There might, you know what I mean? I don't know the division was like it was is today, but there was a middle class. There was a middle level. So I don't think it's factually there was only people had all people had a little.
Okay. Well, also there's a lot less social mobility at that point.
That's true.
So also, like, you get what you get, and so yes, like if you're born in the whatever class you're born in, like that's usually where you're going to end up in life, right? And then I would also say, from a more spiritual perspective, you could say that there is no amount of possession that really is going to give you kind of a sense of fulfillment, and so it'll always be a little, and so you have to look for fulfillment elsewhere.
Right. Fulfillment, I agree with you. Fulfillment cannot come from possessions. I agree with that principle. But still, why are we saying that a person should be happy with a little of their lot? In other words, why don't you just say a person should be happy? In other words, like it says in Pirkei Avos, Ezeh Ashir, who is wealthy, Hasomeach Bechalko, who is happy with their lot. Doesn't that say if it's small or great or medium? Here the Rambam teaches us with the little, which is their lot. Now, he's sharing actually a very important insight psychologically about how we look at our stuff.
Well, we may feel like we have very little when we see what other people have, especially in comparison to this moment. Like, as Adrian calls his apartment, I live in a rat, which is definitely going to be little compared to some of these mansions. But I think it's our mental state that we perceive what we have as to be little, especially, I live on Long Island, so in communities not so far away where there are mansions, or people who live in the city where, like, an apartment building two blocks over can have, like, insane penthouse suites or something like that. So compared to what we can see and what we know other people have, we perceive what we have as being just a little.
Excellent. In other words, when a person's living in the social world, which we do live, we are constantly comparing to others. And psychologically, what we have, we naturally feel, is that we have a little. Okay? Now, even if objectively, all of us are in the realm of, all of us live in the socioeconomic space called middle, in the general called middle class. So, and not to mention, compared to what was true in, our lives compared to a king 100 years ago, is immense. We have indoor plumbing, we have hot and cold water, we can take a shower when we want. The varieties of food that's available, even to a middle-class person, is unbelievable. Not to mention we're having this, I'm not talking about all the technological things. So, objectively, it's as far as many of the luxuries that we, even a regular middle-class person has, is so overwhelmingly more than an aristocrat had even 70 or 50 or 100 years ago. But it doesn't make a difference. Psychologically, we're living in the world of comparison. And there's always somebody who has more. You have an iPhone 8, they have an iPhone 10. You have an 800-foot apartment, this guy has a 1,200-foot apartment. This person has a 1,200-foot, this person has a 2,000-foot. Whatever. There's always more. And the natural tendency is that we feel a sense of entitlement that we deserve to have more stuff. And the amount of stuff that we have is good, but we feel we should have what? A little bit more.
So, Rabbi...
one at a time. Yeah, Adrian, then Chloe.
So just to, like, count on what you just said, I don't think it's just a psychological thing. Like, this hierarchical manner of viewing the world and comparing ourselves to other people. You can observe this in lobsters, even. Jordan Peterson has been a big advocate of this, that it's not just with humans, it's like every, even lobsters compare themselves and have a hierarchy of who is better or less.
Right. It's called who is the alpha male, who is the alpha male, who is the alpha female. It's true for in the animal kingdom. And apparently also in the lobster kingdom. I wasn't aware of that. All right, Chloe, you wanted to make a comment?
I think it's even worse now than it was like for our grandparents' generation because of social media and internet. And I mean, on one hand, it's a lot of people all around the world, if they're living in dictatorships, to see that what they're living is not the norm. But on the other hand, Instagram is just basically all like showing all the possessions you have and all the things you need to buy and all the, it's so much more emphasized, I think, than even your generation growing up.
10,000% correct. So, right. So we live in a, we are being constantly reinforced that what we have is inadequate. Well, that's the essence of the consumer society. The goal of marketing is to say that your life will be so much more complete and so much more enriched if you bought the specific product. Right? I mean, that's what we live in a consumer, that's what living in a consumer society is all about. Now, so therefore, how does this show play upon our sense of entitlement?
Well, one thing that I observed is that it's sort of like these people deserve the highest level of care. Like they're sort of looked at as demigods. So it's not just that they can, because they have the money, but it's almost like they're morally justified in getting, like, the way they were speaking about, you always have to be 10 moves ahead of the client. Like, it just sort of sounded like, you know, these people, it's not just because they're wealthy, but they're sort of like entitled to it.
Yes. Well, that was commenting on the people who are serving. They're the brokers and the various service industry who are trying to serve these people who view themselves as being essentially the elect, you know, God's gifts to mankind. So what the Rama is bringing up, the famous point, is that really that to a person has to be happy in their portion, even if psychologically you feel it's inadequate. That's you know, this is your situation. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't work hard. And again, person should work, not, you know, again, between not working and being consumed by work, the right amount to support themselves, but they should have time for, going back to what Casey's point, for a spiritual pursuit, to be able to be involved in Torah and things like that to nurture your soul, not just to be involved in more things. Now, here we get to the question that Jade brought up very early on, which is question number 8. Do you think fantasizing about other people's luxurious lifestyle is a violation of do not covet? What do you say?
I say no, because we have defined coveting before as wanting something so badly you're going to buy it from the other person and force them to sell something that they're not willing to sell. So we're not going to this homeowner and saying, I'm buying your house, here's a check that's meant $1 million, and she's like, well, it's not for sale. We're not doing that. I would say it's more of a jealousy or an envy as opposed to a coveting.
Okay, so you're saying from the, well, we're going to explore that. Technically, it may not be. Now, does it, how do people conventionally define coveting? Shane has been in my class for 4 years straight, so she's not, I'm having hard pressed to find cards that she's not seen before. So, what do people conventionally think is the phrase when the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not covet? What do most people think?
Jealousy.
Right. Being jealous of the possessions of others. That's the problem. Now, does the Torah think that a person should be jealous of things of others? We just saw the Rambam that no. That may not be the prohibition of coveting, but it's still, what is the Hebrew word for jealousy? Anybody know? What is the Hebrew word? What?
Kina.
Daphne, 100% correct. Thank God you were brought up in a Israeli home, and therefore you knew the word kina. Excellent. Kina means jealousy, okay? What is, let's see, can we define, what is jealousy?
Isn't it like a very irrational thing? Just the idea that if someone has something nice, they're taking it from you. That's why I don't think this show is really about coveting, because the fact that someone has a nice mansion in Malibu, that doesn't mean I can't have it, or like, I think jealousy is this false conception that because someone has something, you don't have it. And that can lead to a lot of problems.
Well, the person, or jealousy is that, is it that I want that, or I want them not to have it?
It's that you want them not to have it. It's a personal thing, almost. Someone else's success is a personal insult to you, anyway. That's how I see jealousy.
Correct. Jealousy is, I have that desire, I desire that object, which is two things, that I should have that possession, and specifically, because I'm just, and I'm good, and I'm great, and they do not deserve it. In other words, a feeling that person should not have that. You know, a classic situation. You know, a new person back. Remember the days when there was a kiddish at MJE. Let me go back to over 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago. So there was a time. There's a little place called Manhattan Jewish Experience, which is on 131 West 86th Street, which on a Shabbos around noon, the service would end, and everybody would pile out of the white room and go into the blue room. And there would be fresh chalent and a variety of different foods depending on the level of sponsorship of the kiddush. We all remember that. And you had what they call the regulars. There's regular people. The regular crowd came in. But then there's every Shabbos always somebody new. And when that new person walked in, let's say a person walked in, what does everybody do? What does everybody do when a new person walks into the kiddush room?
Welcome them.
Exactly. What else?
Well, introduce yourself.
Okay, that's part of the welcoming. This is all nice, but everybody's being very nice and polite. What else do people really do?
Check them out.
Thank you. All right. So first of all, check that. It's called the full body scan from top to bottom. Top, bottom, top. You know what I'm saying? The full checking over. Now, why are people checking everybody out? Say it again, Adrian.
See if they're weird or not.
They're trying to assess the other person. So if women are checking out another woman, and we're not talking about lesbians, but if they're checking out, why are they checking out the other woman? So thank you. Exactly. Is this person an ally?
Is that what people really do?
Yes.
No,
yes.
Saying, I think that's crazy. I have a lot of like vices, but I don't know. Competition?
It's not Daphne, it's not conscious. Daphne's not conscious. They're not going to verbalize that. But when people do the old, you know, the up and down checkout, the guy's checking out the girl, if it's a girl, or the girl's checking out the guy to see their suitability for potential for dating and going out. And we encourage that. Is this guy weird? Is he normal? Normal guy? Beep, 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 beep. All right?
We're like good weird.
Few and far between. We're getting in there. Okay? And if it's a guy checking out a girl, say, well, you know, let's check out the situation over here, and you know, and if she is appealing somehow or another, within a very short amount of time, she has a lot of people like Scott Shapiro and others welcoming her into the community out of the goodness of their heart, because they're friendly people, no ulterior motives involved whatsoever.
It's funny because it sort of looks like Jaws. Like it sort of looks like stars just begin to like surge.
Right.
Ready to count.
Right. Now, if a guy, you know, if the other person, male or female, you know, whatever the gender is, I'm going to leave, make it not gender specific, but if the person has clearly, you know, phenomenal advantages, okay, whatever they may be, already that might elicit the jealousy emotion, because why is that person having these excellences and therefore drawing attention? I should have that. And maybe that person's really a loser. So there's a jealous response of that. I feel there's a sense of entitlement that all good qualities, possessions should belong to me. And of course, Daphne said it's irrational, but of course that's, you know, it's an emotion. So it is by definition irrational.
I think it depends on how you see yourself. I think that if you think of yourself highly, you're going to become resentful. But if you don't have a good self-image, then you're just going to become depressed.
Like sometimes the antidote for one vice is another vice. So if you suffer from jealousy, maybe you need to have more like vanity or pride. I don't know.
Well, so that's what our goal tonight is. The question is, what is the way to deal with? In other words, it's interesting. The first point, number one, is that most people think that the Torah is about actions and words. Words like davening and learning, and actions like, you know, taking a lulav or, you know, helping people out. Here, the Torah is going into the domain of one's mind, in one's feelings, in one's intentions. The Torah is very interested, not just insofar as, you know, the activities of people, the speech of people, which of course it is, but the thoughts and feelings of people are equally as important. So the issue...
Can I just ask one thing about jealousy?
Yes.
We're talking about this in the Talmud class we're doing at the Kibbutz. When it comes to Israel, I was listening to the radio and they said that the Israeli economy is so successful because Israelis kind of suffer from like a paranoia in reverse, meaning like if I don't, why should that guy have it? Why can't I have it? And it's a very Israeli mentality. I mean, I don't know if it's jealousy, but it's this drive to like get things, physical things, like, you know, to work hard, to be innovative so that you could get money and you can be successful. And that's kind of like the driving force of so many Israeli companies. So is there like a good place for I don't know,
So the answer is it has to be balanced. If a person becomes work obsessed and to make the next innovation.
It's the drive of so much success and innovation and ingenuity
There's a pro and a con, because you know that's not the essence of mankind. The person can waste their life doing that.
But I think Israelis are fundamentally different than Americans. I think
they are
the best. You know, I think all Israelis think very highly of themselves.
Right.
And that's why they take action, because they have high self-esteem.
Yes.
A lot of Americans have low self-esteem, so they don't take action. They just become resentful and bitter.
And the self-esteem, though, is driven by taking action. It's not the other way around. You build esteem by doing things in a direction that builds integrity. So I don't know. It's a weird catch for me to do.
Look, the part of the, you know, this goes into the issue about Startup Nation in general. Why were Israelis successful? One, of course, is there's a sense of that their back is against the wall. In other words, they're in an environment in a neighborhood that resents them and wants their destruction. And part of they don't have natural resources, and you know, they've been trained to think. Creatively, one source of creativity and ingenuity really is the Israeli army that teaches. Many of the startups had their beginnings by being trained by the Israeli best and brightest being trained in the Israeli computer intelligence 8200 division, which is a secret group, where they're trained the very best on various computer science and innovation, which they therefore, and after they're done with their stint in the army, they're able to roll that in civilian applications, and that's been a source of success dramatically. I want to now pivot to get to the actual. Let's go to the psukim here. Let me have somebody read. All right. We're gonna go to Stacey. All right, Casey, read the last of the Ten Commandments in the Book of Shemot.
The tenth commandment: Do not covet. Tach mod.
All right. I want you guys to get to learn the Hebrew. It's called Lo Tach Mod.
Lo Tach Mod.
Good. Do not. Yes.
Do not covet. Tach mod. Of your neighbor's house. Do not be covet of your neighbor's wife, his slave, his maid, his ox, his donkey, or anything else that is your neighbor's.
Okay, so that's the famous, you know, the Hebrew, that's Lo Tach Mod, and then they list all the things that you cannot, all the possessions of a person or critical things in the person's life that you cannot be involved in, Chomeda, okay? Then, when Moshe repeats the Ten Commandments in Devarim, he adds a little something. Go ahead, so let's have Chloe Bavakasha.
Do not lo tachmod your friend's wife. Do not desire lo tita ave your friend's house, his field, his male or female slave, his ox, his donkey, or anything else that belongs to your friend.
Uh-huh. So Moshe Rabbeinu added another mitzvah here, that there is desiring. You're not allowed to desire the possessions of others. And you cannot covet them, which of course is not clear what those things are from the open psukim. All right, so let's get a little education here. Let me have somebody else read. Anna, can you read? All right, we're going to go to Suzanne. Suzanne, can you read?
Yeah, anyone who covets, halacha 9, anyone who covets a servant, a maidservant, a house, or utensils that belong to a colleague, or any other article that he can purchase from him, and pressures him with friends and requests until he agrees to sell it to him, violates a negative commandment, even though he pays much money for it, as Exodus 20:14 states, do not covet. The violation of this commandment is not punished by lashes because it does not involve a deed. One does not violate this commandment until one actually takes the article he covets, as reflected by Deuteronomy 7:25. Do not covet the gold and silver on these statutes and take it for yourself. Implied is that the Hebrew tachmod refers to coveting accompanied by a deed.
Excellent. Okay, so let me explain that. So let's take our example. We have the woman. What was her name again? With the Malibu house? Liz? I don't remember.
Liz.
There you go, Liz. Okay, so Liz had the gorgeous Malibu house. Let's say you go to her and say, here, I have a check for $30 million. Okay? I want to buy this house. I want to buy the El Pellegrino. Whatever it's called. Whatever it's called. Okay, and she says, I'm so moved that you would like to buy this house, but this is my dream house, and quite frankly, it's not for sale. Then I hire people to nudge. She says, well, come on, Liz, you're a fool not to sell. You only invested $8 million in this property, and he's willing to give you $25. You're walking away from a pile of cash. What are you doing? And they just go to her time after time again until she is worn down. And then she says, all right, I'll sell it to you for $25 million. She hands me the keys. The contract is drawn up. And she gets the money wired into her account. And so whoever does it, if I did that, I would successfully violate the 10th commandment of Lo Tachmod. Okay? I desired her house, and then I worked on a pressure campaign to get it. Even though I spent $25 million, I didn't steal it from her. She got the money, and she got beyond market value for her house. That's Lo Tachmod. Let's continue on. Halacha 10. Shana, read it out.
Anyone who desires a home, a wife, utensils, or anything else belonging to a colleague that he can acquire from him violates a negative commandment at the time he thinks in his heart, how is it possible to acquire this from him? And his heart is aroused by the manner, as Devarim states in 5:18, do not desire. Desire refers to feelings in the heart alone.
Ah. So the Rambam teaches us that when the pasuk says lo tavet, do not desire. So at the moment, I just saw the video. Okay, let's just work it play by play. And then I work out a plan in my mind. I want that house. I must have that house. That house is mine. I deserve this house. Let me work out a way to get the house. Even if I don't say a word, it's all in my head. I violated a Torah prohibition of not desiring, of desiring the property and possessions of another Jew, another person. Okay? Let's go on. Adrian, Halacha 11. Take it away.
Desire leads to poverty, and poverty leads to robbery. For if the owner does not desire to sell despite the offer of much money and many supplications by friends, person motivated by desire will be moved to robbery, as Micha 2:2 states. They coveted houses and stole. And if the owner stands up against them to save his property, where in another way prevents the person motivated by desire from robbing, he will be moved to murder. Take, for example, the narrative of Ahab and Naboth.
Okay. So the Rambam says that there's also a chain reaction of desiring, lo taveh, leads to acting on that, coveting, and if the person refuses, then the person might be inclined to even steal it from them. And if the person is so obsessed, so jealous, that they must have that object, it's not so rare, it's of course the thing of many, many reality. What's that show on? What's that show that really? There's a show I'm blanking on it that has all these crime shows. What?
CSI.
Well, CSI for sure. A lot of them always will have where a person basically stole something because they coveted it, and then when there was a fight over it, they literally got themselves into a case of murder. Now, does anybody know the story of Ahab and Naboth? It's a famous story in the Book of Kings. Let me tell it to you. King Ahab was the king of the northern kingdom. He's married to a wife named, anybody know? Jezebel. Jezebel is a Phoenician idolatrous queen. Probably there was a conversion, but bottom line, she still worshipped idolatry. Wasn't really taken to heart. Okay, the prophet at the time is no less than Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet. Naboth's palace property abutted a guy named Naboth, and he had a gorgeous vineyard. And Ahav went out to his property and he desired to have that gorgeous, it was a vineyard with an orchard. It was like fantastic. Okay? Gorgeous grapes. And it's in the Shomron, which of course, as you know, is now again, like it was then, the wine and grape capital of Israel. We went to, it wasn't very far. We went to the Shiloh Winery. It's not that far from there, okay? Anyways, the Israel Valley, not that far. So he says to Naboth, he says, look, I love your property. Name your price. And if you don't want money, I'll get you a different property and you'll switch it. But your property's right next to my property. And I'd really love to have my property opened up to have your fantastic orchard and vineyard. It's fantastic. So, Naboth says, Chalil Hashem, far be it from God that I'm going to sell my ancestral property to you. Because it's a boot. This is part of my Nachla, my inheritance. This is my our family stake in the land of Israel. I can't give this up. So the story continues. King Achav trots back to his house, goes into his bedroom, lies on his bed, and turns toward the depressed, dejected, and turns toward the wall. His wife comes and says, the equivalent of, "Honey, why are you so depressed? What's the problem?" And he says that Naboth has a vineyard and an orchard. I want to buy it, but he won't sell it. And he was completely crushed. So Yizeel says, "Honey, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it." What did she do? She hired witnesses that he did a crime and, you know, basically put trumped up charges, and in court got him convicted of a capital crime. Now, Vote was convicted and killed based upon the paid false testimony. And the property of people who get capital punishment, at least in that circumstance, went to the king. So he has a property now. And the scene then goes from that conversation, and there is King Achav enjoying the succulent fruits of his orchard, walking through the vineyard, and guess who shows up? The prophet. Eliyahu the prophet. He says, "Rachatzta, ratzachta v'gam yirashta, you murder and then you inherit." And he calls him out on it. So this is viewed as a quintessential case of where you have jealousy, titaved, desire, coveting, murder.
This sounds so similar to the Torah story.
Well, these stories happen in every society. So here's my question to you: is lo titaved, do not desire other people's property, and working out a plan, is that forbidden because it might lead to robbery or murder?
I think so. Isn't it the start of it?
It is the start of it, but
isn't that why people are so crazy when it comes to the evil eye and poo-poo-poo, and they don't want to tell anyone good news? I mean,
yes,
my family are like super parent. Like, they won't even give you a wedding date or anything until it's like. My stepsister, she wouldn't even tell people what day she was landing or leaving. I mean, it's just crazy.
That's because they view the evil eye, the Ayin Hara, as an extraneous demonic force.
But it is jealousy. Like, some people
will
of the grandkids, or like, because they're afraid of jealousy. And
so,
leading to like things like murder.
All right, so Ayin Hara is eliciting envy and aggression and jealousy that's why, like this, for example, what Liz did by showing off her home for all to see, that's a good example of the violation of Ayin Hara.
Mm-hmm.
You do not bring in a camera crew and a show to highlight your house for no reason. It's not that she needs to sell it. If she had to sell it, then you do what you need to do to sell it. She's just doing it for people. She's getting the satisfaction of bragging about her wealth and her great artistry and her great design. And, you know, she's getting that not humble brag. But that's going to cause everybody to want to do desire and covet and ultimately take it from her because they feel that she's an evil person and she doesn't deserve it. But my question is, does the Torah forbid desire? Let's say you sit there and you think about a plan to get Liz's house, but you don't act on it. You just had a fantasy on the couch. You were bored and you worked out a plan because you love Liz's Malibu house. Is that? And it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't go into coveting. It doesn't go into robbery. And it certainly doesn't go into murder. Is that a problem in its own right, or is it only because it's instrumental to a more horrible end. What do you? So Daphne says, I think you're saying that it's forbidden because it's going to end up in a very bad place.
Well, if it's like a harmless fantasy, that's very normal. I mean, that's not what but do you mean if you're thinking about how to get her house, or you're thinking like, oh, how nice would it be to wake up in a house like hers?
No, that's not the same thing. No, that's called shopping. Okay, if you say like,
I mean, I do that. I subscribe to Architectural Digest, and I find it very beautiful and aspirational. And it's nice to escape and look at nice things. I mean, that's why we go to museums. But it's not like, oh, these things will be mine one day. I'm going to take them from people.
No, I'm saying, but what about the person sitting there and thinking about a way you want that specific thing?
I think the issue, I think, would be more that you create this mindset and this view of looking at others and trying to think how you can get there. So even though at first you may not be formulating a plan and it may immediately to like steal it, if this becomes your mindset and your vision, then it could eventually lead down that path where ultimately worse decisions will be made.
Well, it's true, put the star, where is there evil? Is it evil at step one or step four?
So it's maybe this would be problematic because it starts to get into the question of faith. And what I mean by that is when you are thinking about how to get something else that somebody else has versus earning it on your own or doing something else to create that thing, you're thinking the world is a zero-sum game. And that the only way for you to get something is to take somebody else's versus to build it and to grow it or to merit it yourself. And when you think of the world as a zero-sum game, this is on the assumption that Hashem will not provide enough.
Yes.
And so therefore you're starting to get into violation of just kind of just general faith in Hashem.
I think that you're bringing up a good point as well. That's true, but I'm going to underline one thing because we're running low on time here. It says, as soon as you desires a home or wife or utensil or anything else belonging to a colleague and that he can acquire from him, violates a negative commandment at the time he thinks in his heart, how is it possible to acquire this from him? So the Torah says, at that point, the fact that you violated one of the 613 commandments is saying, this alone is bad. Then he goes on to tell you that in addition to that, you can go from bad to worse. In other words, you can get into what they call a death spiral over here. One lotzavet will then roll into coveting, which will roll into robbery, which can roll into murder ultimately. But this state alone of thinking about how can I acquire this from a person, that alone is a Torah prohibition, which alerts you to that this is an intrinsic problem. So a key point is like this, that what the Torah is asking of us, going back to what the Rama says, we have to be, connecting to what Casey says, there's a statement in Eov, which people, it's called Chelek Elokai Mimal. Chelek, a portion, Elokai, of God, Mimal, from heaven. In other words, every person gets a portion. Okay? In other words, within the... So part of Hashem's world is that there's an intrinsic distribution. Now, obviously, your effort plays a role in that, obviously. But that's your chelek. And whatever your chelek is, whatever your portion is, you got to be happy with it. And basically, if you're not, as Casey said, you're really denying that you're upset at Hashem. How come I didn't get a bigger cut of the pie? How come I got a slender cut? And going back to what was mentioned earlier, I think Casey also brought the point, is that in reality, the more stuff, and somebody mentioned earlier on, just because she's walking, luxuriously through her palatial Malibu house, has no correlation. I know it's difficult to realize this with her personal happiness. Or if she's there, for example, by herself, I guarantee you she's not happy. If she's not feeling it with family and friends, not going to be happy. If she's not using instrumentally to build up the community with chesed and learning and other positive things, she's not living a fulfilled life. So the fact that she has the $20 million Malibu house is not going to be enriching for her. So I think that's very important to point out. So really what the Torah is demanding of us is that if I feel myself taking that jealousy and getting to the point where I need to have that thing, I got to stop myself right there and say, hold on, Penny, why do I feel entitled to have his stuff? That's his stuff. That's it. And why? And then question is, well, why do I feel what I have is inadequate? And why do I feel that? And why do I feel that if I have their stuff, I'm going to be so much happier? So, in other words, the key point is that Torah is asking me and asking each and every one of us not to give in to that childish feeling like I see it, I want it, I deserve it, I must have it. That childish thought pattern is, of course, not true, and it's destructive. And most importantly, it's destructive to each and every one of us to believe that we feel that we're constantly in a state of want, always in a state of lack, always focusing on what I don't have. The bottom line is that...
But the Rambam says that that's our default. The Rambam says be happy with the little you have.
Correct.
I'm acknowledging that we're going to do it, that there's no way around it.
Now, he's saying that you obviously have to put in your a good faith effort of work, but have time to learn. But in other words, the reason why it's be happy with the little you have, because the person psychologically always feels that they have little. You know what I'm saying? It's sort of like accepting their emotion, a person's emotional state. They have to train themselves to be, this is what I got, and I'm happy. If you have your needs, you should be happy. That's it. You know what I'm saying? You can't do this in 1 second because it takes work to do that. But to recognizing that the core, the kernel of this is a childish feeling of entitlement that whatever I see, I should have. For example, if you ever babysit children, you have a 3-year-old child, there's another kid, and you both give each one a cookie, okay? And child one eats that cookie in 5 seconds. And they see the other child who did not eat the cookie. What will the other child invariably want to do to the other child who still has a cookie?
Eat their cookie.
Grab it out of their hand and eat it. Okay? So the bottom line is that a feeling of the child is in each and every one. In other words, those childish feelings don't go away. Okay, that's the Chiddush. Even though I might be 25, 30, 35, 40, I'm 53, those feelings are there. Okay? They don't go away unless you think about them, reflect upon them, deal with them, confront them in a serious, thoughtful manner. Okay? So the lo tetaveh and the lo tachmod is basically dealing with the inner child that feels a sense of entitlement that anything that I see that will advance my sense of coolness or greatness or whatever, I should ask. Because why? I want it. Just like the 3-year-old kid who's grabbing the cookie out of his brother's hand to stuff it in their own face. Okay? So that's really the challenge. And so really, the show really is sort of like arousing these kinds of feelings which are not helpful. You know what I'm saying? Yes, Chloe.
Something. So there's all these alachas that, like, you do, you shall not want, you shall not covet, but it's true that it's interesting that they're not giving a solution or a tactic. Like, one way to deal with that would be to focus on what you have in your life, or, like, why, you know, I feel like you identify a problem that's wonderful, and why doesn't it couple with, like, here are a few solutions, which I'm sure are in Torah, but...
Right, all right, so you're moving toward the end of our class, which is great. The question is, what is the solution to that? So what's the solution to that?
To focus on what you have.
In other words, is the solution to that simply, well, I was looking at my glass half empty. No, it's really half full. But is that gonna happen automatically?
I don't think that's a solution.
And that may, all right. So what do you suggest?
I don't think a solution is that we should see it half full. It might be half empty, and it might be better to look at it half empty. So that will push you like fill it up more, and I think that's great. I think the problem here has to do with how we compare our potential rather than comparing it with what we can achieve. We start to compare it with what others have achieved. And I think that's really the root of the problem. I don't think that it's trying to want more. Like, greed is good. That's
no, so the Rama is saying greed is not good.
No, okay. So let's not say greed, because I mean, that's just from the movie Wall Street. But
right.
One to improve your life is positive value. It's just whether you want to improve it objectively based on your values and your goals, or whether you want to improve it in relation to what other people have and trying to be better than other people and comparing yourself to other people rather than to your potential and your values and your goals.
So I will share with you. This is that we're getting low end of time, but let me sort of like capture a couple of the key elements here. One way the terrorists talking about trying to graduate from a basically changing personal yardsticks measurements. In other words, since we are social creatures, and this is one of my favorite metaphors. Using a Yiddish term, many people are trying to seek becoming a macher. The macher means in Yiddish a player, an accomplished person, a boss, and avoid being a schlepper, a loser. Okay? So there's a schlepper-macher continuum. Okay? So many people's whole life is trying to move up on the macher continuum and they avoid being stuck in Schlepperville. Okay? Avoiding Schlepperville and becoming a macher, or keeping up with the Schwartzes. Okay, these are all ways to say it. So what these mitzvahs are trying to tell you is that's not the measurement of success. You're looking at the wrong yardstick. First of all, it's not what has been publicized on many many studies that after a person hits a middle class price point, money wise. Which they put arbitrarily, I guess, for the average American, $75,000, maybe move it to New York more than that, as a family, more money does not create any more self-reported happiness. So that's number one. So more things does not equal more happiness, A. B is that there's a sense that the Torah wants one thing from a person. To be an adult and not be controlled by my inner child's desires. So the inner child, that is me, wants to have everybody's stuff. I want the cookie. I want the car. I want the Malibu house. And then recognizes that Hashem did not create that world. Hashem, there's a world. There's a portion. There's stuff. It's related. It's linked to work. So therefore, if it's motivation to work a little harder, great. But bottom line is, that's not what really, the goal is to work sufficiently to take care of your needs, but be able to spend your time on more spiritual efforts, learning Torah being what she mentions number one. So it's becoming mature in what I need to be happy and a fulfilled person, A. B, recognizing that I'm struggling with that inner child. And three is to not be crippled by this, desire to be the macher and avoid being the schlepper. To put it very succinctly, give you an example, like if Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Soloveitchik, let's say, okay, great Torah scholar, great educator, etc., would his life, if I have here the Mega Million dollar winning ticket worth $200 million, Would his life be any more improved if I put it into his pocket or not? Would he, or better yet, would he change his life anything? That's the key question. If a person had, the way to measure your happiness element is that if you got sudden wealth, would you change your lifestyle? So I would argue that Rabbi Soloveitchik, who's having a rich life of learning Torah and teaching Torah and being involved in strengthening community, would not change his life at all. In fact, just the opposite. Getting $200 million would be a big burden because now he has to think of ways to how, what is the best way to use that money for the collective good. It would become a burden. So for his personal life, getting sudden wealth would not be helpful. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't make his learning any better. He has food, he has clothing, he has the basic needs. He's living the good life. So the money's not going to do anything. So if you're living the measurement is, if you're living the good life, getting more money is not going to change it. If you think that, oh, if I had $200 million or $100 million, my life would be better. First of all, read a couple books on lottery winners. First of all, most lottery winners in 5 years end up bankrupt and on drugs. When they were a $53,000 a year truck driver, married to their wife of 25 years, had a much better life because they get money, divorce the wife, go gambling, drugs, prostitution, and they lose their money within 5 years. 75% of them. So first of all, it's not so easy to have that amount of money. And B, it just gives you a whole reservoir of bad choices to make, which most people make. And everybody thinks that they'll be different, but the odds are not. So that's not saying that wealth cannot be a blessing, but the reality is happiness, fulfillment, is not correlated. In fact, our greatest scholars were actually poor. Hillel was poor. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was wealthy. But as far as their life, the wife of, living a fulfilled life, they both had fulfilling lives. So if you have what you need, that's it.
Isn't there like a Pirkei Avot that says, who is rich, whoever is happy with what he possesses?
Exactly right. Ezehu Ashir, who is wealthy, Hasamech Bechelka, who is happy with their lot. The Ram just added the term, even though that we generally feel that our lot is little. But that is something that we have to deal with, because that really is, in a certain sense, an illusion. Because that's coming from the social measurement. If you leave the social measurement of the Macher Schlepper continuum, you're liberated, because you have an honest assessment of what you need, and that's it. Many people, for example, let me give you a simple example. Many people believe, if I get that promotion, I'll be so much more happy. But the reality is, they consider like, well, now I have to work more, now I have to manage more people. So yeah, you may have got $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 more, but literally, I'm now a slave to these people, and my life got reduced. People make this mistake all the time. Sometimes a promotion will just make your life terrible. Will make it terrible. It's counterintuitive. The Torah is counterintuitive and really not what our society teaches us. But I'm trying to share with you that ultimately it's really the MS, it's the truth. And it's been shown scientifically with various studies, the big one being that the happiness does not increase beyond having middle class food. In other words, once your basic needs are taken care of, food, clothing, housing, medical, once that's basically taken care of, every additional dollar is not going to really make, it's not going to affect the quality of your life, because a person is not a material, it's not essentially only a material being. And if you're not spending time nourishing your soul, you're going to be miserable. In other words, we learn to see ideas, but you're also learning in the same way that you exercise. You need to exercise and engage your soul, or else you'll have psychological problems. All right, so that's It's a lot of stuff. It's a big area. But the Torah mandated how we have to feel about that. Lo tzaveh, lo tachmod, as being an area, even though it's our inner world, which of course comes from jealousy, to deal with that. So that's really the point. And therefore, these kind of shows, if it elicits these desires, is not so helpful. You know what I'm saying? It depends. You know, you can watch a show for a whole different, you know, a wealth of different reasons. But if it's eliciting that that, you know, coveting, jealousy and coveting feeling, it's not really helping me train myself to be content with what I have. All right, guys, any questions? We're going over time here. I don't want to keep you all night long here. So any questions? All right, it's a lot of stuff to think about. All right, we'll continue this. So I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, and we're coming up a Yom Yerushalayim Sameach. It's Jerusalem Day coming up Thursday night into Friday. Some people are observing it a day early because of Shabbos, and everybody should have what you need and be happy with it.
Thank you so much, Charlie Penny.
All the best, guys.
Bye. Thank you.